In the new book, Disillusioned, Five Families and the Unraveling of America's Suburbs, journalist Benjamin Harold explores how hope, history, and racial denial collide in the suburbs and their schools. Disillusion braids these human stories together with local and national history to reveal a vicious cycle undermining the dreams upon which America's suburbia was built. For generations, upwardly mobile white families have extracted opportunity from the nation's heavily subsidized suburbs that moved on before the bills for maintenance and repair came due. Again, the name of the book is Disillusioned, Five Families and the Unraveling of America's Suburbs. Benjamin Harold joins us on the roundtable this morning. Benjamin, thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me.
What ultimately brought you to this subject in this way? Obviously, you have long been looking and studying America's education system. What brought you to these suburbs and these five families?
Well, I actually grew up in an inner-ring suburb of Pittsburgh called Penn Hills, and I grew up there in the 80s and 90s, and in many ways had like a very stereotypical suburban experience in that time. Like that community worked really well for my family, and the public schools worked really well for me. And so I left in 1994 after graduating high school, and I never really went back. You know, I became went to college and grad school and became a journalist and was really focused on America's cities and urban school systems and did some reporting in rural parts of the country as well. And it really felt like that was the place where, you know, America was really happening. But then around 20 years after I left, all of these headlines started coming out of Penn Hills. You know, it started with the school district had somehow run up this $172 million debt. You know, teachers were being furloughed. Programs were being slashed, budgets cut, property taxes growing up, home values were stagnating. And it was like, wow, wait, what is happening here? And so I wanted to really understand what this kind of spiral was in my hometown and why it was happening, but then also if it was happening in other communities as well. And so that led me on this kind of journey across five different suburban communities all across the United States. And what I found is there's this very common pattern and cycle that is really creating a lot of problems in suburban areas all over the country.
And the reasons and the things that go wrong are similar and different, right? I mean, that's what's so fascinating about it. There are commonalities, and yet.
That's right. And I think part of why it's been so hard for us as a country to talk about this is, one, we have a lot of myths about suburbia. We have these still kind of leave it to Beaver Wonder Years ideas in our head. And America's suburbs are far more diverse than that. There's, you know, both kind of the types of communities we have, inner ring suburbs and outer exurbs and all these different types of places, but also the population and the communities are really diverse in and of themselves. And so part of that is we have this mismatch between our myths and reality. But then the other thing that, you know, is happening is that this cycle that, you know, I end up describing in the book, it's really hard to see if you look at just one community at just a single point in time, because it's really something that plays out over the course of multiple generations and over the course of whole metropolitan areas. So the five communities that I follow really trace that arc. So we start with a new exurban community that's still being built, you know, 5,000 square foot homes still going up outside of Dallas in a community called Lucas. It's about 40 miles north of the city, and, you know, all the way down to the other end of the spectrum to Compton, California, which developed and went through all of this cycle in the 1930s, 40s, 50s. And then the bottom really fell out in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, and is only now just recovering from that. So really trying to show the cycle so you can see where each community is in its own process.
I mean, one of the real keys of the book is that newer suburban families, especially families of color, are getting stuck paying for the opportunity that whiter and wealthier families had in the suburbs. And you really refer to that as a Ponzi scheme, a type of Ponzi scheme that has stuck later investors with the bill.
Yeah, and that's right. And that's why a big part of why this pattern is so alarming. So a Ponzi scheme, you know, in essence, a Ponzi scheme is the idea is I'm going to take someone else's money now and use it to my benefit. And that the cost of repaying that will be borne by someone else down the line who gets stuck with the bag. And so, you know, in essence, that's what's happening. So, you know, so many older suburban communities, like Penn Hills, the community that I grew up in, which is really a prototypical post-war inner ring bedroom suburb, you know, built up in the 1950s and 60s. And so what we saw there was, again, my family got all of these benefits because we had cheap mortgages, there were massive tax breaks, there was new infrastructure, and there was a really good public school system that had been kind of made in the image of families like mine. And so all of these benefits and values kind of accrued to us. But we weren't ever really paying full freight for all of the benefits that we were receiving. And what I mean by that is largely around this kind of issue of planning for repair and maintenance of infrastructure and preparing to adapt and evolve institutions like public school systems to meet the needs of a changing population. And so what you see is, you know, eventually, you know, you keep pushing those costs off into the future and off into the future, but the bill always comes due. And one of the big problems we have, and why I, you know, describe suburbia as this racialized Ponzi scheme, is that so often what has happened is that, you know, upwardly mobile middle-class white families have been able to get all of those benefits and then leave right before the bills come due. And so families of color often tend to come in behind the white families who have left the suburban community, expecting to get that same generous social contract, but instead finding that they're on the hook for all, you know, all of these burdens that have been left behind.
You talk in the book about why looking at education, looking at our public schools is such an important lens, because that's really how you can see the big picture of how these suburban parents are getting that bill and what they're left with.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, I think schools in general are kind of a portal to everything we care most about. It's where we put our visions for the future, where our hopes for our children, you know, our values and what we find most important. Like, all that gets concentrated in public schools. So they become this amazing lens to understand communities and change. And so, and that's especially true in suburbia, where so much of American suburbia, especially post-war suburbia, is really communities that we built as a repository for our visions of the good life in the future, how we deliver our children to a better future. And that's a really powerful thing, and schools are central to that. And so part of really understanding this disillusionment that so many families are feeling and experiencing is realizing that the dreams and ambitions and hopes and visions that had brought them to suburbia isn't really delivering on them anymore. And so that creates this kind of profound disconnect that I think a lot of the country is really wrestling with right now.
Tell us about the five families and what you were looking for, because they're all at different stages in the progress and the process, right?
That's right. And, you know, again, it's important to remember that suburbia is really a dynamic, vibrant, extremely diverse place, or set of places across the country. And so, you know, one of the analyses that we did in the book that really stuck with me and I think about all the time, just because it runs so counter to our stereotypes and myths about suburbia, is that inside suburban public schools, already today, white children are a minority. Like the demographic changes are accelerating really dramatically. And so the families in the book reflect that. I follow an affluent, upper middle class, conservative white family in the Dallas area, but also a professional middle-class black family outside of Atlanta, a multiracial mom who's a progressive parent activist in Evanston, Illinois, Bethany Smith, who's an African-American mom who bought the house three doors down from my childhood home in Penn Hills in 2018. And again, she and I kind of having to wrestle in a very personal way with this Ponzi scheme dynamic. And then also the Hernandez family, who are undocumented immigrants from Mexico and live in Compton, California. So they're really the face of suburbia now. Like, suburbia is a very dynamic place, and I wanted to make sure the book communicated that.
Let's just for a minute focus on the Robinson family. They're outside of Atlanta, suburban Atlanta. You write about the public school system there. This is a well-regarded system. And you write about how that school fails to connect with the Robinsons and their kids, but not only doesn't connect, really alienates them. Give us a sense of that and how it is so effective in really reducing the family and their very spirit.
Yeah, it's a great question. And, you know, the Robinsons were just very generous in sharing their experience and their journey with me. And so, you know, they're both have advanced degrees. When I met Nika Robinson, she was going back to get her PhD in public health, extremely invested in education, you know, have a tremendous social network, strong spiritual foundation, you know, lots of family and friends in the area. And really wanted to be partners with their children's school system. They talked about this all the time of like, hey, you know, our kids are kids. They make mistakes. They act up sometimes. They don't understand things sometimes. We're here as partners and we can bring a lot of resources to bear to help make sure that our kids get this better future that we moved here for and that we're counting on the public schools for. And that kind of works out okay through elementary school. But when their oldest son, Corey, hits middle school, what we saw in Gwinnett County was this pattern we see in suburban communities in the midst of demographic change all over the country. So you have a staff, an administration, a school board, a culture and set of policies that are really still kind of oriented towards the middle class white families who used to live and predominate in that community. But you have a family like the Robinsons who's coming at it from, you know, their own experience and their own background. And so all of these kind of like everyday teenage boy type things that Corey does, you know, tapping his pencil too loudly in class, spending too long in the bathroom, you know, smacking his friends in the on the back of the head because they're horsing around, all of this stuff starts to get very harshly policed. And so you can see these kind of escalating series of punishments and referrals and detentions and suspensions. And the Robinsons are kind of at a loss. They're like, wait, what is happening? We understand our child is not perfect, but we're here trying to establish this connection so we can hold him accountable, correct him, and keep him moving in the right direction. And he's basically a good kid. He gets good grades. And he's a, you know, very charming boy. And the school district, they just will not make that connection. And so one of the moments that really kind of highlighted that for me is there's a meeting at the school. And the Robinsons say, you know what, we're trying to make sure that this is going to be a safe environment for Corey, that we're able to, you know, address some of these challenges and issues that come up. And they want the school system to know who they are. So they bring Corey's grandparents, they bring best friends, they bring his minister, they bring his coach, they bring his mentor, all of these people with the intent of saying, hey, there's this larger village around Corey that can support him, just work with us. And what they're told when they come into that meeting is these people can't come into the meeting because they're not family. And so it leaves the Robinsons feeling this kind of profound sense of not just kind of dissatisfaction with the school environment, but essentially of being told in lots of ways, large and small, you don't really belong here. This isn't really for you. And there's no other real good option for them. They can pay a lot of money for private school. They can move back into an older community that's predominantly Black, but where there's fewer resources. They can try to move somewhere else. But they, like many of the families in the book, just come to this conclusion that there's like just not a good option for giving your child opportunities and keeping them safe and nurtured and seen and respected.
So here are three, I think, important facts about what you just talked about. So of that school district, in your telling, Black and brown children make up about 2/3 of the district's students.
Mm-hmm.
Meanwhile, prior to 2018, they had never elected a person of color to their school board,
right.
Mostly white women, and one, you point out, had been in the seat for over 47 years. So
right.
How do we change that? I mean, just the representation of looking at a now mostly Black and brown school district and changing the leadership to a point where what you just described happening to the Robinson family does not happen to other families.
You know, it's a great question, and I think part of why this kind of moment we're experiencing and this reckoning that is now at hand is so profound. And you see that same dynamic that the Robinsons experienced as an individual family at their school playing out on this kind of systemic and political level as well. So in 2018, Gwinnett County finally did elect its first school board member of color, a young man named Everton Blair Jr., who's a child of Jamaican immigrants and had actually grown up and gone to school in Gwinnett County Public Schools. And so, you know, when he started, it was, you know, he was just one member among a 5-member board. There were limited changes he could do, and you could see his kind of frustration and his waiting just ability to start making changes. And it was really in 2020 when we saw that shift. So all of a sudden, you had three younger progressive challengers of color running against the incumbents, who were older white women who had held their seats for a combined 80-plus years. And two of the young progressives won. And so there was a progressive majority all of a sudden on the board. And so what you saw was this tension. The folks who had been in control of the institution and had really, you know, had largely been in control of the county for generations were of a sense of, hey, we created this really great thing that everyone wanted to come here and be part of. Why do you want to change it now? We have to preserve it, not change it. But for a lot of the families that come in, what they are coming with is this experience of that system you built, those institutions you built, worked for some families before, but they're not working in the same way for us now. And so we do need to change it. We need to reflect our values, our interests, our priorities, our culture, our history, our backgrounds. And that's what you see as the fight in school board elections and then also just at the school board meeting. So after the progressives of color gained a majority of the board, what we saw was the school board meetings in Gwinnett County, which historically had been very sleepy, mundane affairs, all of a sudden being these kind of like you have police presence and, you know, people really literally screaming into the microphone, white parents saying, we will not let you take away our schools. And so that tension runs really deep, and we're seeing it play out all over the country.
You write this book about the promises and really the betrayals of the suburbs and that suburban dream. And you litter it with these facts and these portrayals of the five families. And in the end, you give the epilogue to one person, Bethany Smith. And I'm interested in what led you to that decision, but also how it really perfectly ends this story about these families and about the suburbs and about the disillusionment.
Yeah. And so when I went back to Penn Hills, my hometown, when I started seeing all of those bad, you know, headlines about all this bad news, you know, I wanted to go back and see and understand not only what was happening and why, but who is bearing the cost of it. And so what became very clear very quickly was that the benefits that Penn Hills had delivered in prior generations had come to families like mine. When I graduated from Penn Hills High School in 1994, the school system was 72% white. But by the time all of this bad news started proliferating, the school system was now 63% black. And so you can see this Ponzi scheme, this racial Ponzi scheme dynamic playing out in the specific community. And so what I did was, you know, I went back to the street where I grew up and I started knocking on doors. And three doors down from my childhood home, I met Bethany, who had bought the house in 2018, hoping for that same kind of generous suburban social contract, and was, you know, rapidly kind of confronting this reality that, you know, the reality of what she was actually, you know, had found in Penn Hills. And so, you know, we talked about that a lot and we worked through it a lot. And part of the challenge was, you know, really, like, she's the person there, like, that has to live it. I could look at it from afar and say, I see this dynamic. I see how my family participated in it. I talk in the book about my own kind of evolution of recognizing the advantages and benefits that my white family received, et cetera, et cetera. But at the end of the day, it was really Bethany that had to live with it and figure out a way to make it work. And also, importantly, that it was Bethany who was bringing a dream and a vision and a notion of community into Penn Hills that is actually what the community really needs. This sense of how do we build a place that repairs these problems from the past? And that's a collective responsibility for all of us, not just the residents who are stuck in those places now. And then how do we also kind of do that in a way where we build this kind, rebuild this kind of sense of intergenerational social contract, so that, what, you know, the good things in a community are sustainable and can be passed down from one generation to the next, rather than kind of just leaving all the problems behind. And Bethany gave incredibly beautiful voice to that. And I'm just so thrilled that she agreed to write the epilogue and to do that, and that she, you know, challenged me on some of my own blind spots that I wasn't seeing, that kind of created the space for this.
So talk a little bit about that challenging. I mean, did it take you a little time to actually hear what she was saying?
Well, at one point, Bethany confronted me and she said, listen, you know, I'm all for this book. I'm all for what you're doing. I enjoy talking to you, but I'm really uncomfortable with this. You know, I'm uncomfortable with you as a white man coming back into this community that you left and, you know, essentially taking my story and going to use it for your own purposes and, you know, repeating this dynamic. And, you know, it was a hard thing to hear because she was exactly right. And so, you know, we ended up not talking for several weeks, probably over a month, as, you know, she was praying on whether she wanted to continue with the project. And I was really working through, like, what is a way to address her very legitimate concerns. But so the wonderful wonderful thing is that, you know, Bethany is a person from the very first conversation we had, she always surprised me. She always had an insight or an analysis or an experience or story that really just kind of made me see and think about things in new ways. And I felt very confident that, you know, given the opportunity and the space to do that on a broader scale, not just with me, but for readers of the book, that it would be the same. And so when I extended that invitation, I didn't know if she would accept it or not. And it turned out that writing is actually a passion of Bethany's, which I didn't know at the time and came to learn later, and that she really knocked it out of the park.
It's a very powerful way to end a very powerful book about these families and about our suburbs. I'll end with this, which is simply, there is hope in the story, and you seem to have those optimistic moments. And I just look at, as we are in a long slog of an election year, of how you look at these issues and how they'll be discussed over the coming months.
Well, I think we can expect that the conversation is still going to be volatile and fraught. The underlying forces behind these dynamics, both the accelerating demographic changes in suburbia, and really, you know, we've run up against the limits of our ability to just keep running away from the problem. Like, we can't just keep building new communities further and further out from downtown, leaving our messes behind and running away from them, leaving someone else to deal with them. Like, the bills are coming due, and we all are in a place now where we have to face them. And so that's a fraught moment. It's a volatile moment, and I expect that it will be an issue at both local and national level coming through the 2024 campaign. But like you said, I think there is a lot of hope and bright spot in there as well, because what I saw in every suburban community that I went to, there are parents and citizens, in some cases and students, really working on these issues, really working to make things better and different, really working to reinvent, refashion, reimagine this suburban social contract in a way that's way more inclusive, that's, you know, and focused on getting resources and opportunities to the kids and families who are historically excluded from suburbia, and also doing that in a way that's more sustainable. And I think part of what I hope the book really does is help people, as you read it, to say, oh, wait, not only is this what's happening in my hometown, but this struggle that I've been fighting to change the dress code in my kid's school so that she can wear braids without being hassled about it, or to, you know, push for a more diverse teaching staff, or to try and get this road repaired. All of those things are part and parcel of this larger struggle. So being able to see that our individual fights in our local communities are connected to each other, I think there's a lot of power and hope in that, and I expect that we'll see that continue.
The name of the book is Disillusion: Five Families and the Unraveling of America's Suburbs. The book is published by Penguin Press. Benjamin Harrell, thank you so much for sharing with us this morning. A great pleasure to have you on the program.
Thank you for having me.
Again, the name of the book is Disillusion: Five Families and the Unraveling of America's Suburbs. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.